This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Chapter 5. Advice from the Caterpillar. The Caterpillar and Alice looked at each other for some time in silence. At last, the Caterpillar took the hookah out of its mouth and addressed her in a languid, sleepy voice. "Who are you?" said the Caterpillar. This was not encouraging opening for a conversation. Alice replied rather shyly, I hardly know, sir. Just at present, at least I knew who I was when I got up in the morning, but I think I must have changed several times since then." "What do you mean by that?" the Caterpillar said sternly. "Explain yourself." I can't explain myself, I'm afraid, sir," said Alice, "because I'm not myself, you see." "I don't see," said the Caterpillar. "Sound familiar?" "I'm afraid I can't put it more clearly," Alice replied rather politely, "for I can't understand it myself to begin with, and being so many different sizes in a day is confusing." "It isn't," said the Caterpillar. "Well, perhaps you haven't found so yet," said Alice, "but when you have, and you turn into a chrysalis, and you will someday, you know, and then after that into a butterfly, I should think you'll feel a little queer, won't you?" "Not a bit," said the Caterpillar. "Well, perhaps your feelings may be different," said Alice. "All I know is it would feel very queer to me." "You," said the Caterpillar contemptuously. "Who are you?" Which brought them back to the beginning again. Alice felt a little irritated at the Caterpillar's making such very short remarks, and she drew herself up and said very gravely, "I think you ought to tell me who you are first." "Why?" said the Caterpillar. Here was another puzzling question. And as Alice could not think of any good reason, and as the Caterpillar seemed to be in a very unpleasant state of mind, she turned away. "Come back," said the Caterpillar, who called after her. "I've something important to say." This sounded promising. "Certainly." Alice turned and came back. "Keep your temper," said the Caterpillar. "Is that all?" Alice swallowing down her anger as she could. "No," said the Caterpillar. Alice thought she might as well wait, as she had nothing else to do, and perhaps after all, he might tell her something worth hearing. For some minutes it puffed away without speaking, but at last it unfolded its arms, took the hookah out of its mouth again and said, "So, you think you've changed? Do you?" "I'm afraid I am, sir," said Alice. "I can't remember things as I used to, and I don't keep the same size for 10 minutes altogether." "What size do you want to be?" he asked. "Oh, I'm not particular to size," Alice hastily replied. "Only one doesn't like changing so often, you know." "I don't know," said the Caterpillar. Alice said nothing. She had never been so contradicted in her life before, and she felt she was losing her temper. "Are you content now?" said the Caterpillar. "Well, I should like to be a little larger, sir, if you wouldn't mind," said Alice. 3 inches is such a wretched height to be. It's a very good height indeed, said the caterpillar angrily, rearing itself upright to exactly 3 inches high. But I'm not used to it, pleaded poor Alice in a piteous tone. And she thought of herself. I wish creatures wouldn't be so easily offended. You'll get used to it in time, said the caterpillar, and he put the hookah into its mouth and began smoking again. This time Alice waited patiently until it chose to speak again. In a minute or two, the caterpillar took the hookah out of its mouth and yawned twice, shook itself, then got down off the mushroom, crawled away in the grass, merely remarking as it went away, one side will make you grow taller, and the other side will make you grow shorter. One side of what? The other side of what? Thought Alice to herself. Of the mushroom, said the caterpillar, just as she had asked it aloud, and in another moment he was out of sight. Alice remained looking thoughtfully at the mushroom for a minute, trying to make out which were the two sides of it. And it was perfectly round. And she found this a very difficult question. However, at last she stretched her arms as round as and as far as they would go and broke off a bit of the edge with each hand. And now, which is which? Who are you? So you think you've changed? So many. Which is which? So many good entry points in this tale. So I've had this relationship to Alice for a good bit of my life since I was young. So she was, I think, 7 in the tale. She'd be 150 today. And I started to collect books, only Alice in Wonderland. And I had them in all sizes. I had the one from Cracker Jacks, which was like a postage stamp, to very large, giant books. And I remember I had made contact with the monastery, and there was another favorite. I used to drive 3 hours to get here for the Sunday program from around Philly. And there was also a flea market at the same time as the Sunday program, which I loved too, because I got a lot of art supplies there. And I remember one morning I was like, monastery, flea market. 15 minutes, 3 hours. Dharma, junk. I went for the flea market. And lo and behold, at one table, there was a copy of Alice in Wonderland. Looking at the copyright, it was the year I was born. I did not have that in my collection. And it was so old, crumbly. The binding had no more glue. And so when I opened it, all the pages came out, and the top one was Alice in a cartoon, in a illustration, talking to the mushroom, talking to the caterpillar on the mushroom. And the caption said, who are you? And I just, it was like this big, you know, moment, like the choice I made, and then this question just like falls out of the book, you know. And so I still have that book, the Maloney one, and the Cracker Jack one that wasn't hard to pack with me. And I started to cry when I read that, when that slipped out. I started to weep. It was just, I just was weeping, and the person that was behind their booth was like, just take it. Like, it's okay. Like, you didn't break it, you know. And I was like, you don't understand, you know. And then the next weekend, I came for a Zen training weekend, like many of you just came, but I came here. And Daido's talk, lo and behold, the first talk I heard here was Advice of the Caterpillar in that weekend. And I was thinking about why I loved Alice, you know, because she was both an ordinary girl and a rebel, in a sense. She was kind of a rebel. Her nature, she had courage, curiosity, and I just love the part in movies and in the illustrations where she was falling through the rabbit hole into Wonderland, and she was just looking around. She didn't grab anything. She just free fell, and I would just go like, oh, with her, you know, in that picture. And I found this, I've been reading this book by Ponlop Rinpoche called Rebel Buddha, and suddenly I was like, oh, I've been reading this. And he states, what is a rebel Buddha like? It is the renegade that gets you to switch your allegiance from asleep to the awakened state. The mission is to instigate a revolution of mind. That's a rebel Buddha. And a rebel, he says, is one who questions, resists, refuses to obey, or rises against the unjust or unreasonable control of an authority or tradition. It's a rebel. And Buddha is the awakened mind. So he's putting those two together. I remember one of my teachers, not from here, or it was in art actually, was talking about a person. They said, yeah, they're a rebel, but they're a rebel without a cause. And I was just, it kind of reminded me of just being a rebel, and then when you have sort of the Buddha mind, and how, like, the cause and the effect begins to develop. So she thinks differently than those around her. And I think this rebellious streak is in all of us in some way. Just entering practice is kind of a rebellion, going against the stream of staying unawake. It may lay dormant until it's provoked into expression. As a positive force, it will nurture with wisdom and compassion, can free us from fear and ignorance. But when it's full of anger and resentment, we can see it turns into a force that's destructive, that can harm ourselves just as much as it harms others. I think deep down we all want to find some meaningful truth about who we are. We're always looking for it. And we can each, I think of many sung and unsung heroes and heroines, politically, historically, socially, ancestral rebels who stand out for their courage, compassion, what they did for the cause of liberty and justice. And at the same time, there were many who they challenged, that they were regarded as troublemakers, their company not so welcome, and even their lives were taken for it. Because they keep coming back to the questions nobody will ask. That's a rebel. Why do any of us enter a spiritual practice? What are we looking for? How does this question, who are you, land in your body, in your mind? And the journey will be different for each one of us. The certainty in an uncertain world of what we're doing. And this switch your allegiance from asleep to the awakened state, to instigate a revolution of mind. This sort of bravery comes from our Buddha nature. Basic intelligence, which begins to show this bravery. Nothing to hold on to, nothing to prove, to continue something. A brave, spacious attitude charged with curiosity, warmth, intelligence, space, questions. So what brings us? Suffering, desire to know something, just curious, wanting to feel and understand the squeeze of an uncertain life, impermanence. These are important questions to keep alive, and sometimes they get lost or forgotten or refused in comfort. We sort of have amnesia. What am I doing? What? But they don't go away. So sometimes we get a whiff, we get a scent, we get a taste, we get a touch that the questions are with us, that they are us. So how do we allow them in? Tell them they're important now. They're important now. Now as ever. And something will come through, maybe an answer, maybe another question, maybe more questions. And in that, to let go of images and roles, identities, and see what arises now, just being there to meet it, quiet, listening, giving space, that we are this living, profound question all the time. Something not yet known. Who are you? The caterpillar gets right to the fundamental, doesn't he? Like an acupuncture needle. Right into whatever that spot is that we get hit with. I hardly know, sir, just at present. I know who I was when I got up this morning, but I think I must have changed several times since then. So do you ever wake up and notice all these changes? I'm sure a moment we're brilliant, we're dull, we're cranky, hesitant, calm, open-hearted, tight as a fist, sensitive, maybe scared, hurried, refusing, joyful, loving everyone and everything. How could we ever have been different? And then, wah. Should I stay or should I go? There's so many places I was reflecting. I don't recognize who I am. I don't know on some level, because that's too limiting, whatever I can come up with. So which is the real one? Which is which? Which one actually describes us or you? So the art of noticing what arises means awareness is working. Awareness is what we are. Where can be aware of itself. It can be an empty awareness. It doesn't know. It knows it doesn't know, and it's aware. This is what we can do. And we are encouraged to investigate this process, right, over and over again in Zazen, into our movement, to see how our mind constructs I, me, mine out of very simple experiences of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, mind states, constructs of identity, and see how then that becomes the foundation for our view, our concepts and opinions. We are the awareness, and we can let it be as it is, with the quality of presence that doesn't need to identify with this or that, yesterday or tomorrow. Live the movement of uncertainty, which is really true. Things are uncertain. And of course, we would have to be in a very deep fog not to see this right now or ever, but particularly now, how our individual lives, our collective lives are being pushed and squeezed into deeper and deeper levels of uncertainty with no end in sight. And we haven't caught up with the grief of loss, the slam of loss, of identity, of people dying, of people being killed. This is the fact of where we all are, all of us. And whether we admit it or not, or choose to worry about it or ignore it, our life, always fragile, is more fragile than ever. Beside my bed, I keep the Dhammapada, words of the Buddha. I like it's short sometimes to read that before closing my eyes, just a verse. And I picked this one this week. Not in the sky, not in the sea, not in the clefts of the mountains, is there a known spot in the whole world where one might live free from being overcome by death. Jeez, sounds a little depressing, sorry. But it boxes us right in, doesn't it? Oh, it's just like, and nowhere to turn. I admit I was deciding whether or not to use it or repeat it, but the very intensity of the uncertainties around us, really, I felt no option. I couldn't not use it. One veil after another veil falling down with immense opportunity. If we allow these startling revelations to penetrate our heart and our body and our mind, internally, externally. As someone said on one of our Zooms, they said the masks are going on as the masks are falling off. Ride the uncertainties if we use every morsel of our experience to see how it can set us free. But I'm not used to it, pleaded poor Alice in a piteous tone. I like that little accent, a piteous tone. And she thought of herself, I wish the creatures wouldn't be so easily offended. You'll get used to it in time, said the caterpillar. So with uncertain, it arrives often with offended, which is so deeply lodged in our wounded bodies, to defended, refusal, to think we have or to have ready answers. And I think it's natural to feel this sense of defense when we receive direct feedback about something. But it is the defensiveness that functions as refusal that harms. So we can you feel it and then not refuse the squeeze or how it hit, the offense? Refusal to see, feel, or understand or take that stretch to go deeper. That's a rebel Buddha. You know this kind of feeling, how we can let offense keep taking us through the heart, out of the head, through the knowing. And I was reflecting again on corona, which is crown. This is the crown virus, the head chakra, where we've lived in ways that we've left our bodies behind. So in a way, this is causing us both the physical illness, the bodily illness, and the mental, the crown that needs to open. Sonia Rhys Taylor. She writes in her reading, I listened to her reading, the body is not an apology. She says, we will not go back to normal. Normal never was. Our pre-corona existence was not normal, other than we normalized greed, inequity, exhaustion, depletion, extraction, disconnection, confusion, rage, hoarding, hate, and lack. We should not long to return, my friends. We are being given the opportunity to stitch a new garment, one that fits all of humanity and nature. Thank you. And then somebody brought in this line from the Faith Mind poem, and I was just like, oh, what a gift. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. And when a thing can no longer offend, it ceases to exist in the old way. So Pema Chodron, as you may know, wrote a book called Comfortable with Uncertainty. What a coupling of words. Comfortable with uncertainty. She says, those who train wholeheartedly in awaking bodhicitta are called bodhisattvas, who enter challenging situations in order to alleviate suffering. They are willing to cut through personal reactivity and self-deception. They are dedicated to uncovering the basic, undistorted energy of bodhicitta. They never know what will happen to us next. We can try to control the uncontrollable by looking for security and predictability, always hoping to be comfortable and safe. But the truth is that we can never avoid uncertainty. This not knowing is part of the adventure. It's also what makes us afraid. She says, wherever we are, we can train, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, meditation, cultivating the four limitless qualities of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, not harming. With the help of these practices, we will find the tenderness of bodhicitta in sorrow and in gratitude, behind the hardness of rage and the shakiness of fear. In loneliness, as well as in kindness, we can uncover the soft spot of basic goodness. But bodhicitta training offers no promise of happy endings. Rather, this I who wants to find security, who wants something to hold on to, will finally learn to grow up. The root of suffering is resisting the certainty that no matter what the circumstances, uncertainty is all we truly have. And to repeat that, bodhicitta is the spontaneous wish that we don't suffer, that we feel the pain that we share with others. Bodhi means awake, enlightened, or completely open, and citta, mind, heart, attitude, bodhicitta. She says it's important to understand it's not something we either have or we don't, or something we need to acquire. It is a way of relating to the mind and the world based on seeing the nature of things in an unconfused way, the illusion of an inherently fixed self. One who has this motivation is called a bodhisattva. Its nature is to test all what we can be. That's why we hear the bodhisattva path takes courage, perhaps, because we're going to get tested. We're going to get tested that it's not in our head, that it is our whole being. Because our comfort zones will get zapped. We'll get tested big time. We are being tested. The spontaneous wish that we don't suffer, that we feel the pain, that we share with others, and that we have these practices, the help of these practices, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, four immeasurables. A practitioner of the Buddha's Dharma chooses to move into the uncertainty as a choice, not something forced upon us by our world or life circumstances. It may, but as choice then. So what is uncertainty? Well, it's not fixed, destined, dependable, reliable, settled, inevitable, incapable of suffering, of failing. And when we see we're thrown into disarray, are we not into uncertainty? Those were dictionary definitions of certainty. Destined, settled, reliable, inevitable. Those are definitions of certainty. There seems to be no fixed point, no coherent direction, helplessness, a fear, a sense of death. Because when there's no fixed point, when there's nothing to depend on, the self that each of us calls I faces the uncertainty of that I continuing. So we feel the death of the fixed, the settled, the inevitable, the dependable self. And that's why at the heart of the matter we fear uncertainty so much. So much. And we're pushed to be so sure. That's valued. It's a cultural agreement to be sure. To be certain. I was talking to someone this morning who's on this edge of her work, and she's has to be a certain person with certainty and sureness, and inside her she's like, but I know I'm not. I'm uncertain. I can talk about facts and things, but it's not dependable. So she's working with that. From an artist's point of view, choreographer Agnes DeMille says, living is a form of not being sure, not knowing next, what next or how. The moment you know, you begin to die a little. The artist never entirely knows. We guess, we may be wrong, but we take leap after leap in the dark. That's the key of the expression of the ineffable, is that I don't know. And there's enough of relying on that uncertainty as what's true. An experience of the not known, the not fixed, not mine, not thought, is the experience of not, which we begin in with practice and focusing on the breath. The breath, like uncertainty, is always moving, isn't it? It's not fixed. You observe this. It's always rising and falling, always changing, long, short, deep, shallow. The breath is not anything, and yet it's our one constant. It's the first thing we do take when we're born, and it's the last thing we do when we die. With one constant in between. The breath can only be breathed one moment at a time. We cannot breathe two breaths at once. The breath is simple, and the breath can only be breathed now. The breath can only be breathed here and never there. The now and the breath aren't fixed. They move. They move all the time. So we see this uncertainty right in us. And yet they're constant and they're dependable. We can depend that we're always getting the next breath, depending that the systems are working okay. We don't have to think, oh, I have to get the next breath. It's here. Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, and Mara asked, perhaps Mara was Buddha's caterpillar, by whose authority do you take this seat? Buddha touched the earth. He sat down in his aloneness, not trying to be like someone or something else. Had to work through all of that. Or try to control or manage his life. He just sat down, just being completely true to his own yearning, to his search. And it took a long time, as we know, and a lot of spiritual practice to purge the hundreds of generations of conditioning out of his system so he could finally sit under that tree. He could finally embody his aloneness. Can you imagine what it would be like to relieve ourselves of this immensity of human conditioning? But some conditioning, of course, is very useful. If it wasn't for conditioning, we wouldn't be here. Our hearts beat, our blood flows, our breath moves, our eyes blink. Without our management, it's conditioned to do this. It's our biology. Over millions of years, it's evolved so that mostly we run on automatic. So what we're dealing with is more of a psychological conditioning. And once it gets in our system, once it gets set in our system, we become afraid of our own aloneness. Mostly, or maybe because it's so unimaginably unknown. And we can quite literally wake up and out of all of our identifications, our grasping onto form and memory, all the way right down and through our gender, our race. We can actually do this. Only through it. It may be unimaginable, like things are, until they happen. Like think of yourself 10 years ago and the things you might have done from then till now. It's like, no, that's unimaginable. And it's been done. It's happened. And something like this truly happens as we rediscover who we are. Wakefulness starts to move down and through every cell as we begin the clearing house. Clearing the house. In order to really do this, there has to be a deep embrace of our aloneness in togetherness. And how that works best, from what I learned and from what Alice shows, stay in wonder, stay in inquiry, stay in a question. Live that question. Uncertainty is necessary. It's the movement of life. And the movement of life is certain and constant and dependable. There is only the movement of life. This movement is now. The now is certain. It is the fixed point. If we trust the movement and we stop clinging to this illusion of certainty and trust the movement, trust the now, the certainty of the uncertain now, and the certainty of uncertain change, that's called freedom. That's what we chant. This is nirvana. We cross over in a minute. Our true, essential, complete self comes through. We feel it. We have experienced it. One doesn't like changing so often, you know. Indeed. It's one of the hardest things. And the Buddha said, the world, or we can say us, whose very nature is to change, is constantly determined to become something else. If we is at the mercy of change, only happy when caught up in the process of change. Only happy when caught up in the process of change. But this love of change contains a great measure of fear, and this fear itself is what we call dukkha, suffering. Brenda Uhland, who was a writer in 1938, this was another flea market find, this book she wrote called If You Want to Write. And in it, she counsels, the only way to find your true self is by recklessness and freedom. True self is never a fixed thing. True self is always in motion, like music, a river of life, changing, moving, failing, suffering, learning, shining. That is why you must freely and recklessly make new mistakes. Make new mistakes and not fret about them. In Daido Roshi's prologue in his presentation of this koan, he says, the very body and mind of all beings is as great and boundless as the universe itself. As for how small it is finer than a single atom. We should understand that holding on and letting go are not another's doing. Rolling up and rolling out are both within one's own power. If you want to free what is stuck and loosen that which is bound, simply remove all traces of mental activity. At this very moment, if one's vision and hearing are clear, and color and sound are purely perceived, tell me, which side is the right side? This side doesn't reach it. That side doesn't reach it. Neither this or that misses it. Both this and that are 10,000 miles from the truth. Avoid the slightest trace of right and wrong and say a word. Which is which? Many of us have had a glimpse, an experience of not two, if not all of us, at some point. Sometimes longer. And it doesn't mean that in any particular moment we will never experience division again in some way. We will. There's a lot in storage. Daido Roshi's capping verse. Rather than free the body, free the mind. When the mind is at peace, the body is at peace. When body and mind are both set free, the way is clear and undisguised. Ride the fear, ride the uncertainties, and set ourselves free in it. I watched one of Vima Lasara, who was here. I watched one of her TED Talks, and it was about let go of your stinking thinking. That's what she called it. Can we let go? That's how she freed herself. She said, I let go of my stinking thinking. One side will make you grow taller, and the other side will make you grow shorter. One side of what? The other side of what? Thought Alice to herself. Of the mushroom. Alice remained looking thoughtfully at the mushroom for a minute, trying to make out which were the two sides of it, as it was perfectly round. She found this a very difficult question. Perfectly round. That's you. That's me. Perfectly round. That's everything, containing everything. So can we stretch our arms around any single thing as far as they will go? Break off a bit, any piece of the edge. In each hand. And now, which is which? Let us rest our hunger.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.